From the Sky News Centre at 6. Theresa May says additional panel members will now sit on the independent inquiry into the Grenfell Tower disaster. They'll join the second half of Judge Sir Martin Moore-Bick's investigation. The Prime Minister initially decided against the move. More details from Dan Whitehead.
Theresa May now issuing a letter to Sir Martin Moore-Bick saying that she believes the time is right to ensure that the inquiry panel has the necessary breadth of skills and diversity of expertise to appoint two additional panel members to the chairmanship.
A truth recovery body and an independent investigation unit could be set up to examine Northern Ireland's violent past. Former soldiers and police officers will not be immune from prosecution. More grammar school places being created in England after ministers boosted funding by £50 million. Laura Safe reports.
The Education Secretary says the new investment is about filling gaps and improving standards.
It's about where the parental demand is, where the need is, and to make sure there is an excellent education available nearby.
But Labour says the focus is too narrow.
The Conservatives have abandoned most children of this country.
This teacher says fundamental reform is required.
We should be expanding grammar schools by having them in every town and abolishing the 11 plus.
Meanwhile, new faith schools also being introduced will be able to take all their pupils from one religion.
Yacht company boss has apologised to the families of four men lost at sea when the vessel they're on, Cheeky Rafiki, capsized in the Atlantic. Douglas Innes received a 15-month prison sentence, suspended for 2 years for not ensuring the men's safety. Thousands of Volkswagen and Seat cars are going to be recalled over safety fears. At least 12,000 VW Polos and an unknown number of Seat Aronas and Ibizas will be affected because of faulty seatbelts. And the first mosque in the Outer Hebrides has opened. A derelict building on the Isle of Lewis has been converted after a crowdfunding campaign raised £94,000. That's the latest. I'm Charlie Max.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is Cabinet Member for Adult Social Care, Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe and Withy with Helen Hollenden, Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is lurking too. After the 6 o'clock news, he's the investigative journalist who arguably broke the stories that led to the setting up of the National Inquiry into Institutionalised and Westminster Child Sex Abuse. The so-called VIP Defile Inquiry, now on its fourth chair, Alexis Jay. And apparently, as he explains, it's not being run by her, but by Home Office lawyers from the very government department the inquiry is supposed to be investigating. Alexis Jay ran the Rotherham inquiry, which decided not to prosecute police or social workers after 15 years of child sexual abuse in the city, mainly of children in local authority care homes. Thousands of crimes have been reported to police, but no prosecutions. Also, the exchange of fire between Iran and Israel after Trump pulled out of the JCPOA Iran agreement. We hear from the Israeli Prime Minister's office. And also the French-based terrorist group supported by Trump's new lawyer and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. It's like ISIS in Iraq and Syria, hell-bent on toppling the Iranian leadership. They're called MEK and MKO, and we find out why some terrorists are such good guys we give them British taxpayers' money. Also in the House of Commons this week, the White Helmets, filmmakers and medics get a robust defence from Prime Minister Theresa May. It's all in the second hour after six. Very brief weather forecast this week. Sunny on Sunday, next Tuesday and Wednesday too, although a bit grotty on Monday. Rainy next Friday and Saturday weekend. Sunny on Sunday next weekend, and a good sunny week the week after that. So that was not the official weather forecast from the weatheroutlook.com. That was just me looking briefly at my phone a minute ago. Helping us review this week's news, it's Cabinet Member for Adult Social Care, Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe and Withy Wood, Helen Holland. Hi, Helen. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Can you start by telling us a bit about your portfolio. Adult social care is so important. We don't get a lot of news coverage of it, but of course we all pretty much have relatives, friends or whatever that when they get to elderly or in their adult years need social care of some sort. And at the moment it is absolutely under attack from central government.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I've had this portfolio now for just over a year. And I must admit that when Marvin had his reshuffle and offered me this job, my heart kind of sank. Because although I've been a counsellor, as you know, for a very long time, I've never really worked on adult social care at all. And to have had the year that I've had, I have learnt so much. I've been to so many organisations in the city. And to do it at a time when, as you say, the budgets are being squeezed. So it's about us changing the way we do things, but not in a kind of dressing that up. They're cuts, really, but we're calling them by another name. It's a fundamental look at how we do stuff. And I've been really pleased. I mean, Tim's here, but colleagues of his, including my predecessor, Claire Campion-Smith, who's just stood down from the council, but she's been very supportive of what we've been doing. So have other cross-party
members.
So
what have you been doing? Let's get down to brass tacks.
What we've been doing is this, that if you look, as I did when I first came into it, at where the money went and what other local authorities do, the first thing that hit me between the eyes was that Bristol uses far more residential and nursing care than any other of the core cities, any other comparator that you'd like to name. And you know how expensive that is. And actually, it isn't the desired outcome. Most people don't think that they want to end their days in a nursing home. It's essential for some people, but not for the number that Bristol is putting into nursing homes. And some of that was because of the lack of home care.
Now, are these private homes, or are they city council run? Because I think most of the city council ones have gone now, haven't they?
There's still a city council home not very far from here.
One.
In Redfield.
Okay.
And the others are provided by Some in the private sector, some in the charitable sector. So the first thing we had to do, rather than just stop sending people into residential homes but have no alternative, was to build up the home care workforce and the market in Bristol. And we've done that. We've done it by spending more on it so that the workers who are in the home care workforce get a decent wage.
Is this private or in-house?
It's a mixture. It's a mixture. And again, there's many in the charitable sector. So that's one of the things we've done. And that started to turn it round. So we've had about a 4% increase in the amount of home care. And the hospitals, because, you know, the dreaded thing that you hear all the time is about delayed transfers of care. And both Southmead and the BRI, and they're the trusts which run them, are kind of, you know, red flagged by government about those issues. And some of that is down to the provision of alternatives for when people come out of hospital. So it's been a huge learning curve. I've met loads of organisations. There are some fantastic organisations in the city, right from very small lunch clubs, voluntary dementia groups, all sorts of things, right up to the big charitable organisations like St Peter's and St Monica's. I've met both of the hospitals. We've got integrated teams of hospital social workers and the council social workers in the discharge teams in both of the major hospitals. There's so much going on. And it is, you know, it's over a third of the council's budget.
So what, how much? On how much annually?
£130 million.
So that all sounds great. It sounds like you're dealing with the problem, but obviously things do go wrong. Who should people talk to, and who can people get if things do go wrong and people don't feel they're getting proper care?
Well, I mean, there's a number of routes. It depends on the scale of what's wrong. But I've told people to contact me, especially some of the changes that we're putting in place, because it's one thing for me to have a report saying that the changes, you know, are going well. There's been a few hiccups, but we're ironing those out. But I want to hear from people direct. So if there are people, and people do, they email me. Some email the mayor, but the mayor's office always passes those on to me. We've got a very, very good, and I'm very confident in them, senior officer team. And there's also, of course, the Adult Safeguarding Board, which is a partnership board of all the relevant organisations, the City Council, police, health, or everybody around the table who needs to be. And they particularly look at adult safeguarding issues. And if there has been a serious case review, then those reviews are looked at by the safeguarding board.
So I'm also joined by Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Tim, how do you think that the council are dealing with this? Because central government are just cutting so much from local authority budgets, really starving local authorities right around the country, particularly, of course, the fact that many of them are urban areas which are not Conservative voting, so they don't necessarily really care that much about what happens to some of the big conurbations like Bristol here, places like Manchester, etc.
Well, this is a challenge for all councils. I mean, demographically, our population is getting older. The good news is the joys of modern medicine, people are living longer. The problems that councils face is that we are not really being provided with the funding to match the challenge. And I listened very carefully to what Helen said, and I thought a lot of that sounded very positive. But the reality is we do drop the ball here in Bristol, just as any council does and any organisation would. And what I would say to people, if they're listening, who feel that they're not getting the service they should, or are parents or friends or daughters or sons of people, is please do contact Helen or your local councillor. We can actually make a difference. I had a case myself about a month ago, which was really concerning. But within a week of putting pressure on officers, everything had actually been resolved.
Without going into detail, can you just give us an idea of what the problem was?
I had a resident with an illness and disabilities transferred from hospital and actually left bedbound for over 12 weeks, which was unacceptable. But once, I've got to say, I'd actually contacted a senior officer, all credit to them, it was resolved, I would have said, actually nearly within hours, certainly within a couple of days. So, I mean, mistakes happen, but what's important is people don't live with those mistakes. They do raise those concerns with us as councillors, and we will work with our residents to try to ensure they get the best service they can. But, of course, finances are limited. Councils are really challenged at the moment, and obviously we are prioritising social care.
So if you see someone, if you see someone getting not getting the service they deserve, don't hesitate, folks. Pick up the phone, not necessarily to everyone, to Helen, but to your local councillor, and hopefully you know there can be some effort can be made.
Can I just say something on phoning, Tony, because that's one of the other things that we've changed. So it used to be that, say that you were worried about your neighbour, you hadn't seen them going out for a few days, or you'd come back and you'd found that they'd left the front door open, or you just didn't think that they were coping, and you might think, well, I'll phone social services, as people would have called it. And very often the result of that would have been that they would say, we'll send a social worker around, and that social worker going round would end up with an assessment which would lead to a care package to the person. So what we're doing now, so if you phone Care Direct, those are people who have been trained to have a much more in-depth conversation with you or the family member or the person, in fact, saying, well, what do you really need? And quite often there's an intermediate stage where family, friends, neighbours, somebody will say, that's all right, I'll always go and do the shopping. I'll pop in on the way to work and make sure that they're up and about and they're taking their tablets, whatever. And so instead of going straight to an expensive care package, our first tier of support is called Help to Help Yourself, and that's much more about engaging people with community organisations, friends and neighbours. So the whole thing about being, you know, in the sausage machine is delayed, and I think that most people think that that's a much better thing. So that's all down to that first conversation. So I'd also encourage your listeners to ring Care Direct.
Yeah, keep an eye on your neighbours, folks, because the system isn't always looking after people the way it should. Martin Summers, this is really surely a result of what happened in 2008, and this is a kind of knock-on effect where central government just doesn't seem to have the money that it did to be able to, I mean, we're still paying tax taxes, except some people aren't. They're in their money's in tax havens. So, I mean, what's the general sort of macroeconomic position? And will we ever get that fixed, or are we just literally going to have to stomach this?
Well, I think one of the problems we're facing going forward is that adult social care is going to eat up all of the local authorities' budgets, and nothing else will be done. Yeah, and because that's statutory as well, and therefore you've got to do it. I would argue, frankly, that this should be an NHS responsibility, because that would make it much more straightforward.
Well, I disagree about it being an NHS. I mean, there is talk about having a national care service as well as a national health service. My worry, and we know this, don't we, that the NHS is not particularly accountable.
True.
And I think the great strength, you know, we've been here, Tim, myself, we've said if people have got a problem, ring us. We know that if people ring their MP, councillor, about the NHS, much more difficult to get an answer.
Well, I take that on board.
And I think the other thing, if I may say, is about where the burden of taxation lies. Mm. And the Conservative government, propped up by the Lib Dems in the coalition past, have been very clever at transferring the balance of who pays. So we know that council tax is going up, and yet people feel that they're getting less for their money. And so the burden of the taxation falls on people through the council tax system, when actually a lot of this, and integrating health and social care, which has been talked about for years but never really done. I mean, they're beginning to do it in Manchester, because health budgets have gone to the Andy Burnham as the Metro Mayor for the Greater Manchester area. But nowhere else has really done it. We try to do as much as we can. But in the end, the accountability for NHS money and the accountability for social care money lies in two different places.
Well, I take all that on board. I mean, it's a kind of, you know, it's not going to be given to the central government to manage in any foreseeable future. But I think it's basically something that, you know, the bed blocking issue and so on, because you've got two organisations which have got to deal with what is essentially one continuum of problems. So that's the issue. And of course, the other problem is that as a society, we simply don't value this enough.
Okay, anyway, last week there was local elections, and we had a bit of a discussion about it last week. And I thought we'd just start off a discussion about how Labour did, because really Labour should possibly have been doing better at this stage in a central Conservative government in the local elections. So let's have a listen now to one of Labour's top spokespeople. He actually resigned when Jeremy Corbyn became leader of the Labour Party. That's Chuka Ramuna. And this is what he had to say about the local election result on BBC's Question Time last night, when he was asked, is Corbyn mania dead?
Oh, this is for you. Who quit the front bench when Corbyn became leader. Is Corbyn mania dead as a result of the local election results?
I'm not sure there was mass Corbyn mania in the first place, but I think we need to get away, you know, as a Labour Party. It's not about the personality. I think what you want to know is, what are we actually going to do to change your lives, whether you are in, you know, a community like mine or the kind of community that you refer to.
I think Hallam wants to know about Jeremy Corbyn. That's why you asked the question.
I've just told you that I don't
think... You don't think he does want to know that?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, if you listen to the answer, I said I didn't believe that there was mass Corbyn mania, and even if we do believe in mania, I'm not sure mania is what people want to know. They want to know, what are the policy solutions? What are we going to do to make sure we have more affordable housing, better jobs, better paid jobs? What are we going to do to ensure that the circumstances of your birth do not determine where you end up in
life? All right,
you're
giving us
Labour
policy.
That's what people are interested in. That happens to be what I believe, actually.
Yeah. What about the local election results? Do they show
success
for Labour?
Well, we need to do better. No, there's no doubt about it. We need to do better to win.
We need to do better to win, he said. But, Martin, actually the result is, looking at the BBC's own projection for the House of Commons, was a plus 21 seats in the House of Commons and minus 38 Conservatives as a projection from last week's local elections.
Well, the general punditry, of course, is that at this stage of a parliament, a local election, the government usually gets a kicking, and they didn't get as much of a kicking as might have been expected. But I think the new politics isn't really about that. There's a polarisation going on.
Chukwuemunna point out how well, in the House of Commons projection, the Labour Party did?
Well, because in actual fact, what would happen there, that Labour, if there was a projection to a national election, Labour would be the biggest single party, but it wouldn't be able to form
a
government.
That's actually quite a good result.
Yes, I know. It is quite a good result, but it's also, in the past, the punditry always was that at this stage of an electoral cycle, the local elections, the government should be given a complete thrashing, as it was in the Thatcher era. But I think what's actually happening because of Brexit and all sorts of other things is that there's a polarisation taking place. The Labour vote is solid. We're still creeping forward, but it's very solid. It's not going to melt away.
So why did we're in a new kind of setup. Why did we not hear from Chukwuemunna, supposedly a Labour Party MP, that actually how well the Labour Party did? I plus 21 projection in a House of Commons in a general election.
Well, the reason being that Chukwuemunna was as historically hostile to Corbyn as the leader, and I think he did play the straight bat there. He just said, I'm not going to fall into the trap of attacking the leader that everybody in the party has elected
well,
twice.
Well, I should hope not, anyway.
Which is absolutely
not,
right.
Not, he's not as good of him, isn't he? He's not going to.
Well, yes, that's right. But he can't escape the fact that he did in the past. He was hostile to
Tim. What do you make of the local election results?
Well, coming from a Liberal Democrat standpoint, I think we were generally fairly pleased.
We were plus 10, by the way, in the House of Commons. That's for the BBC projection.
I mean, I'm not going to go into those projections. I think we all know
the Tories were the big losers. Well, I mean, the thing is to try and translate the trends around the country, even though, of course, it's a completely different vote, but the trends into what would happen in a general election.
Yeah, I understand what the people who like to try to project these projections to us. I try not to argue. I do also subscribe to the fact there are often lots of local conditions and stuff which change things. Overall, you can take a look. Was it a great night for Labour? No. Was it a disaster for Labour? Well, no, it wasn't. Was it a good night for the Tories? The answer is probably yes, because they should have been expecting more of a thrashing. They did get the odd kicking. Certainly we challenged them very hard. We took certain very safe areas like South Cambridgeshire off them. I think we're as a party still trying to work out how that happened. But we also broke back into our stronghold in southwest London. I think what this does show, though, is that a lot of people would like to see third-party politics dead in this country. It's not. People are still looking for alternatives to the big two, and I think that's good for democracy.
And we've got a by-election coming up. Are you going to win that one, do you think?
I think
it's in 2 weeks' time. I think
it is in a couple of weeks' time. I think we have a very strong chance of winning that one. It's going to be a tight fight, as often is in that area, between ourselves and the Conservatives. But I think things are looking very strong for our
candidate. Is it Westbury on Trim? Am I right?
It's Westbury on Trim and Henlees.
Okay. How do you think you're going to get on anyway?
If you want my projection, I think we will win it by probably 100 votes.
Okay. Helen, what do you make of this result? And why isn't Chukwuemunna sort of banging the table and say, actually, we did rather well?
Well, I don't know why he isn't, because actually I was at a breakfast meeting yesterday morning in London with Andrew Gwynn, who's the shadow local government minister for Labour. And he was dissing this story that we didn't do as well as we should, particularly because it was in London. He was talking about the London boroughs. And he reeled off a list of virtually all of the London boroughs in which we'd gained seats. I think there maybe had been some over-promising or people getting overexcited with, oh, we could take Westminster and Kensington and Chelsea. Well, you know, these are, it's going to be a long time before Labour runs those local authorities. But I do think that, you know, it's already been said that playing out national politics when it's about who do you want to run your local council is always tricky. And I regretted myself, I have to say, that some of the Labour message was, let's send a message to Theresa May. Well, it isn't Theresa May who empties your bins, provides social care that we've been talking about this evening. So I do think that conflating, as they say, those issues about what was the local result and how would that play out if there was a general election tomorrow, because we know that, first of all, about twice as many people would go out if it was actually a general election as they do in the local authorities, which is a cause of great regret to all of us. I'm sure that only, you know, 30-35% of people use their vote, but that's the case. And also people would take other things into consideration. So I think, and I've already been in contact with Plymouth. I was down in Plymouth on election day. We took it back. We stormed it there. And, you know, that's great that we've been able to take Plymouth back for
listeners
Labour.
Of those BBC projection figures, because, I mean, if you're listening to any of the national press, I wouldn't have realised any of this. Labour were up 21 seats in the House of Commons. Conservatives were down 38 seats in the House of Commons. Lib Dems were up 10. And others, which I imagine is think people like Sinn Féin and the SNP, were up 7. So the Conservatives did really badly, actually, minus 38 MPs as a national projection.
And I think it, overall in the councillor numbers, with when all the ups and downs are, you know, taken out, the overall we gained 71 and the Tories about 30. So
Okay, so let's have a listen now to what Esther McVeigh had to say. She's the Department for Work and Pensions Secretary now, and what she had to say on BBC Question Time, the answer to this question, is Corbyn mania dead?
Corbynism is unravelling, and what we're seeing is a far left. What we're seeing is a momentum. I know it militant from Liverpool in the 1980s. You've got MacDonald, who is his shadow chancellor, who agrees in Marxism. What we're seeing
you've
is
got
the
a foreign
unravelling
secretary who laughs at dead Libyans. Don't put yourself in a position that's
holier than now. Very ugly far left organisation.
Very ugly far left, Martin.
I think what was disappointing for momentum people was...
Sorry, I didn't mean that, you personally.
No, I'm just trying to answer what you're saying, is that we chucked quite a lot of foot soldiers at Swindon, but it didn't budge because there's a definite, you know, there's a polarisation going on. And, of course, in a national election, lots of young people turned out in the national election, you know, last year, who don't vote in local elections and are not mobilised. And we've actually got quite a lot of people now who are pretty committed to going out and knocking on doors. And that's good, but it doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to get the votes at the end of the day.
This by-election...
And, you know, you've got to recognise that people are scared of some aspects of, you know, the wealthy classes are pretty scared about what might happen.
The Westbury on Trim by-election, Thursday, 2 weeks' time. People will have the choice of four candidates when the polls open, May the 24th. Graham Donald for the Liberal Democrat Party, Ian Moss for the Green Party, Steve Smith for the Conservative Party, and Theresa Stratford for the Labour Party. But if past elections are anything to go by, it's going to be largely a fight between the Lib Dems and the Conservatives. So we'll see how that one pans out. And we'll be covering it on the Friday straight away afterwards with one of the candidates at least here on this programme.
In the general election last year, Darren Jones did extremely well in that part of the city. So it isn't as if we're not working over there.
Okay. Now, so the next excerpt we have is Prime Minister's Questions, and it's Jeremy Corbyn and the Prime Minister Theresa May discussing Brexit and certain comments made by a certain foreign secretary.
How can they negotiate in the future interests of people's jobs and living standards when cabinet members are more interested in putting their own futures first? Fundamentally, Mr. Deputy Speaker, how can this government negotiate a good deal for Britain to defend people's jobs and living standards when they're unable to reach an agreement within themselves?
Prime Minister.
I'll tell this, the Right Honourable Gentleman, what this government has been doing to defend jobs. A balanced approach to the economy opposed by the Labour Party. Changes in legislation to more workers' rights, often opposed by the Labour Party. We have been ensuring that we see the jobs being created in this country. Employment rate at its highest rate since records began. What we are seeing in relation to the unemployment rate is that it's the lowest rate for 40 years or more. This is a government that is putting jobs first at every stage of what we are doing. And last week, what we saw up and down this country, whether in Barnet or Dudley or Peterborough, was the British people voting to reject the Back to the Future economic policy of the Labour Party and the broken promises of Labour. They don't trust Labour and they don't trust their leader.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I was also watching Question Time last night, and when Esther McVeigh started talking about the employment figures, she was really challenged by the rest of the panel on that. And we've been talking about social care tonight, so forgive me just for going back to that for a moment. But when you look at the potential impact on the NHS, nurses have already started going back. The hostile environment doesn't just relate to the Windrush and immigration issues. It relates to how people feel now since the Brexit vote and whether they feel welcome here or not. And so the impact of Brexit on those jobs, which are still going to need doing, whatever happens with the digital assistive technology, all of those things that people talk about, and they do certainly have a part to play, but we are going to need people to do those jobs. And I think it's a tragedy, just to go to Boris Johnson for a moment, that you know, we know that we had to have, Cameron gave us the referendum to satisfy his own party, and now what's happened, even though we've had the referendum, we've had the result, we're still being torn apart by the arguments within the Tory party. And I just think it's outrageous that we all have to sit as bystanders while that's all going on.
Is a country suffering as a result of this, Tim? I'm sure you'll say yes, because imagine you don't agree with the result of the vote at all, the referendum vote anyway.
Well, a lot of promises were made to people about what Brexit would look like. And the only thing I think we now know since the Brexit vote is that every single one of those promises has been broken. We were told that we would have an arrangement like Norway. That's now been thrown out. We were told that we would be Switzerland. No chance. The reality is there is no policy to deliver a Brexit that works for Britain. I'm not here to try to stop the will of the British people. I think that the people spoke that night, but unfortunately the promises made to them were all false. So I think what we need to do now is come up with the best possible deal that can be achieved and put that back before the people and say, this is the offer. This is what it is in black and white. Do you wish to sign up to that or not? Now, I know that that's not supported by everybody, but I do hope that those people who want to put this country first back that, because I think in the end of the day, we must actually put our national interest above ideology. And I do fear that we are being ruled by ideology rather than national interest at the moment.
Meanwhile, back in the real world, Prime Minister's questions mentioned universal credit, talked about problems with that. We seem to have this almost every week here, and the link to people who are going on to universal credit having increasingly to turn to food banks.
Jeff Smith. Thank you, Mr. Deputy Speaker. In the last year, the Trussell Trust has given out over 3,000 food parcels to my constituents in South Manchester, half of them to families with children. The Trust say that the government's flawed rollout of universal credit has fuelled the 13% rise in food bank use over the last year. How does the Prime Minister explain that rise?
Prime Minister.
Obviously, the Honourable Gentleman knows that we don't want to see anybody having to use food banks. What we did in relation to universal credit, as we are rolling it out, is listen to concerns that have raised, and we have changed the arrangements for universal credit as a result.
Well, that's a very quick answer, skirting over, not really an answer at all, I suppose. But Helen, surely the real problem here is nothing to do with benefits and universal credit. It's just that jobs aren't paying enough to feed people. And many of the people who are claiming these benefits are working, but they just haven't got enough money to feed the kids. And we heard half of the new people who are having to claim food banks have got children.
Exactly, and I can't remember what the proportion is, but it's about half of them at least who are working. We've heard about nurses having to use food banks. This is outrageous, isn't it? It's 2018.
Let's have your explanation. Why are wages so depressed?
Wages are depressed, I think, because they can get away with it. That's what's happened, isn't it? And so the case for a living wage was made, but the living wage has been set at a level which isn't really, as we know, because of housing costs in particular. Food costs are predicted to rise astronomically after Brexit. So a fundamental relook at how the benefit system supports people, even where there would still be benefits for people in low wages, but that we've got to get the system right, because clearly we haven't... In Bristol, we haven't seen the true impact yet of universal credit, because the rollout hasn't been at the speed it's been in other parts of the country. But we know it's going to have a disastrous effect.
Tim, has it got something to do with cheap foreign migrant labour, you know, effectively economic migrants?
I think those have been the convenient people for the government to blame. That is not, though, the case. The reality is that that too many of the rich have got away with paying low wages. But on the universal benefit thing, there's another group of people who've been really badly trapped, and that is the self-employed. The reality is, with the change of the economy, the desizing of lots of larger organizations, lots of people have become self-employed who weren't before. Now, the reality is, when you first become self-employed, it's not unusual that you don't make a lot of money, but universal credit actually equates that you make at least £1,000 a month. The reality for a lot of new people who are self-employed, they're not making that, and actually universal credit then just discards that gap and says, well, you have to make it up, and there's no way they can. So the promise by the government that employment will always pay has been actually proved to be a lie. And I think they really do need to look radically at universal credit. I mean, it's going to start hitting Bristol, I think, in June. So we're about to see this roll out here. And I think people need to sort of become fully aware of how this may affect their situation.
Well, there's some massive effect changes coming in through universal credit. And when the BBC or no national media reports it, thank God YouTube is there to report various things. And here's a chap called Tony Linford, who's got his own YouTube channel, and where he explains the sinister side, what he says anyway, is the sinister side to universal credit.
As it stands at the moment, even if all of your other benefits are stopped, you can approach the housing people at the council, you can go to your council offices, and something people need to know, you can make a claim for housing benefit on nil income. I would repeat that to anybody who finds themselves in this position. Go straight to your council offices, make a claim for housing benefit on nil income, and apparently that will also get you some vouchers towards food banks, and it will get you some help with at least electricity and gas. So, but once all of this is put in one universal credit payment, yeah, once it's all there, then they have the instant means to literally make you homeless. Yeah, they can just stop the benefits instantaneously, and probably within a matter of weeks you will be evicted and you will be on the streets, and there will be no more possibility that the housing benefit could at least be paid and keep the roof over your head, even though the Department of Work and Pensions, or Workfare and Punishment, had taken everything from you. It's about control. There's more behind universal credit, whether you are working, not working, poor, in work poor, sick, disabled, a carer. There's a lot going on behind that, and it's about them controlling your life and controlling whether you have the means to even stay alive or not.
Well, interestingly enough, I'm part of the universal credit revolution. It's been rolled out to me about 2 years ago, and I'm in work, but I'm still getting universal credit because what I'm earning isn't sufficient to cover my rent. And in other words, lots of my universal credit goes straight to my private landlords who are buying the house at my expense. And of course, that's where the subsidy goes. The other thing about universal credit, which is very pernicious, is that they won't pay the landlords directly, and therefore private landlords have made it clear, they made it clear from the get-go, that they won't rent to people on universal credit.
What about the point, Martin, what about the point that he was making there, Tony Linford, that now it's universal credit, when that gets withdrawn, it means you don't have any, you know, so at the moment you've got housing benefit as a separate system, yeah? So it's very, very easy to take away your other benefits, not so easy to take away housing benefit. And also, there's a period of warning. So they say, they'll say to you, whatever, is it 2 months or something, that we are thinking about taking away your housing benefit. You need to produce this evidence that you still need it. And then, and at least that's a 2 month gap. With universal credit, there may be no gap at all.
Well, in actual fact, registered homelessness has massively increased since universal credit was brought in. It's absolutely clear. I think the causality is absolutely clear. And this is and of course the gap before you get paid. The purpose of housing benefit previously was when people turn up and say, I'm skint, I'm just been put out of work, you make sure they keep their housing. Whereas of course if you then say you've got to wait 6 weeks before we'll give you the first money, and we won't cover that 6 weeks. Yeah, that 6 weeks you've got to find the money. I was able to get help from my family, but of course some people can't. Yeah. And then they get evicted. And we're actually seeing massive increases of measured homelessness directly related to housing to universal credit. And they could easily change this by just going back to the old system of paying people directly as soon as they claim, and also paying the landlords directly.
And they could go back to the old system.
But if they did that, Martin, Ian Duncan Smith,
they could go back to the old system.
Would not be happy. We're doing all this to keep him happy.
They could go back to the old system of housing people as well. That might help. Anyway, Tim, what do you make of this claim about universal credit, that actually what it's doing is it's meaning that not only your in-work benefits or your disabled benefit or your income support, whatever it is, can be taken away, but your housing benefit as well straight away?
Well, the concept behind universal credit seemed a good one, to simplify benefits, bring them together and make sure that work would always pay, but that there was a simplified safety net, which was complicated, and billions of pounds of benefits actually were not being claimed by people. Now, that was the theory. The practice, of course, is proving to be very different. And I can understand here the point that's being made, that at the moment, of course, housing benefit is administered by the local councils on behalf of government, but still we administer it. Whereas the other benefits is paid directly by the Department of Works and Pensions. So when you're sanctioned at the job centre, they may take away your you may take away your money for your food, but your rent is still being paid. That is quite a worrying idea, that those sanctions could be expanded. And I think it is the sanctions which have been a big cause for the expansion of homelessness. It's not the only cause, but there are a lot of sanctions now being imposed. It does appear that they look for any minutiae, any mistake, and someone is sanctioned.
Well, the awful thing here is that you could be sick, you could be actually very ill, and because you're so ill, you can't make an appointment or of some sort, and then so you just get your money taken away, Helen.
Well, I think that's true, but also there's all sorts of other things, aren't there? I've helped a woman in my ward out very recently who had got to go abroad for an extended period because of a death in the family. In her home family, and the fact that her benefits would have stopped could have potentially meant that in the 6 weeks while she was away, her house would have been taken away from her. I mean, this is ridiculous. People on 0 hours, people who earn very different amount 1 week to the next, the benefit system can't keep up with those variations in their income, and so they can end up finding themselves without money, having to explain they can't get their benefit backdated. All of those things are really having an impact already, and that's before, as Tim's already said, it's actually properly introduced here. So there's huge problems ahead of us, and I know that in the council they've been briefing councillors about it. They're trying to get the welfare rights people on it, but they know that there'll be a huge workload coming their way.
One does worry a little bit about whether the local authority is able to deal with things like this, and maybe one of the things I noticed was it was just announced in the Bristol Post this week that the council is going to increase the threshold of people signing petitions in order to get debate at the council chamber. People will soon need to collect 4,500 signatures rather than 3,500 signatures to trigger a debate. Now, you first, Tim. I mean, this just sounds... I mean, are there lots of debates at the City Council that are triggered by these petitions at the moment? No. Too many?
No, there's maybe 6 or 7 a year, and it does seem to me unnecessary. There will be a vote about this. Are there good debates?
I mean, you know, do you think this is a useful contribution, this petition system?
Well, what it does is it gives you a chance to showcase the issue and make sure it's brought to the attention of the leading councillors in the the city. I think it is generally a fairly good system. It has meant petitions are far more important than the past. They're not just put to one side on a desk. You are centre stage in the council. I think the current level, the current threshold is roughly right. I think the new threshold really is not justified. And it's based, of course, now on 1% of the entire population rather than 1% of the electoral register. Well, that 1% of the entire population includes babies and people who actually can't sign a petition. So that doesn't really seem to be very justifiable.
Helen, you're on the cabinet. Why have you done this? Or why do you want to do this?
Well, I wasn't party to the discussions about
nothing to do with me.
No, seriously, I wasn't. I was party to it.
Do you support
before.
It?
Well, I'm not sure that it's sending out the right message, because I think Tim's right that we have had some really good debates because issues have people have been passionate about.
Why are we even thinking?
Can I just say this bit? I think the frustration for people who've put those petitions sometimes is we have the debate at the council about it, but they don't come away knowing what we're going to do with it. So it doesn't actually lead to, and we're going to ask for a cabinet report or whatever.
Why are they doing it? If you say it's not you, why is it happening?
Well, I'm afraid I don't know. As I understand it, there's been a working group, cross-party working group, working on the Constitution.
Well, I can explain. I'm afraid it was a proposal given to the leaders by the Mayor. We understand it was going through the Labour group, but each proposal will have a vote at the annual council meeting, and there will be a vote on that. So I hope Helen will vote with me and vote against that proposal, and perhaps we can have a bit of sense. I would also like to actually reform the system. The idea of a follow-up report back to full council is an excellent idea. I think maybe we could work on an amendment together.
Tim, what do you think of the state of local democracy generally? I mean, how are things getting more open or more secretive under Marvin?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily under Marvin. For me, I think it's under the mayoral system that our secrecy has greatly increased. We have seen far more use of exempt reports. We find it quite difficult to sometimes...
What do you mean by an exempt report?
So exempt report means it's not published for the public. You might get a cover sheet. You might get a bit more, but a great deal of it will be exempted.
Some of it is commercially confidential, surely.
Well, that's been the argument, but unbelievably, I mean, this truly is unbelievable. The report done into the libraries, which was paid for by the government to do a report into an alternative provision for the libraries, has been made exempt and is not going to be published. I mean, this is absolutely ludicrous.
So you,
what is the commercial sensitivity?
Who is able to get
report?
Sight of that? If it's paid by public money, is paid for a report into what might happen with our libraries, and who is allowed to see it?
Well, so far, the chair of the commission into the libraries, Anthony Negus, one of my fellow councillors, had to argue quite strongly to even get sight of it. And to get sight of it, he had to go along to an office and be watched by our officers as he looked at the report. I, of course, have no idea what's in the report because he can't tell me what's in the report.
How about
I would
Helen,
have to demand
have you,
access
Helen,
myself.
Have you been allowed to see it?
I haven't asked for sight of that report. I dare say that if I was to, I would be able to see it, but it would be under the same circumstances. I think there's two things here. One is that the, you know, what Tim said about the mayoral system, I think, is probably kind of generally the case wherever there's a mayor, that the same sorts of concerns come up. But the other is, and again, we've already talked about this, that the cuts in the local authority budget mean there is much less resource for supporting councillors of the administration party and of the other parties looking at stuff through scrutiny, select committees, all of those things. So we've worked on different ways of delivering scrutiny, because for my mind, remember, I've sat on both sides of the table, well, Tim has too, so I know how important it is to have councillors doing valuable pieces of work, helpfully looking at some of the big wicked issues where really we want to get cross-party support.
But I mean, surely that's an argument for publishing stuff, in other words, erring on the side of openness rather than secrecy.
That would always be my instinct. But
Martin?
Well, I would agree with that. I'm not really a fan of the mayoral system, as people who listen to the show regularly will know. I think local democracy is being eviscerated. It's been going on for years. It started in the Thatcher era and it's still going on. And it creates huge problems because, of course, national government dumps all the stuff on local government, which is where the opposition is strong, and then of course they have to deal with their constituents saying, why are you cutting our library? We voted for you not to do that.
Okay, now we're going to go back to Prime Minister's questions, and a question from just over the border in Wales about appeals to the Department of Work and Pensions.
Waiting times for PIP tribunals in Wales have quadrupled over the past 4 years. My constituent, Alan McKittrick, is suffering with prostate cancer, angina, diabetes, COPD, arthritis, hernias, mental ill health, dizziness, blackout and ulcers. Yet his initial PIP claim was refused. He then waited 56 weeks for an appeal, which he won. Will the Prime Minister apologise to Alan, and when will she end this hostile environment towards sick and disabled people?
Prime Minister!
To the Honourable Gentleman, obviously members across this House raise issues about the PIP process, and the Department for Work and Pensions is consistently looking at the whole of the PIP process. But one of the issues that he raised in his question was the health of the individual concerned. Now, as he sits for a Welsh constituency, I would have thought if he wants to talk about health, he should talk to the Labour government in Wales.
Yeah. You know, the system is run centrally. The PIP system isn't administered by the Welsh Assembly, is it? It's the system that has been put in place by the Tories.
Okay, so anyway, also lots of... I mean, I thought we'd maybe do a bit of stuff on the international story, if you don't mind, because this whole business of Donald Trump pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal has really caused sort of shockwaves around the world, really, as well as other things he's pulled out of the Paris climate talks. There's... Martin, maybe you can help me. There's another big organisation he pulled out of, UNESCO it was, wasn't yeah. it? He's pulled out of too. It almost seems like we've got this weird isolationist policy. So let's have a listen now to one of the contributors to BBC Question Time, Chloe Westley, who was I think doing PR or something for the Vote Leave campaign and part of the Taxpayers Alliance, what she had to say about Trump and his way of dealing with particularly this time I think with North Korea.
Chloe Westley.
Well, I think there are a lot of people that are quick to criticise his actions just because they hate him as a person and don't, you know, stop to think about what he's actually done. Look, when he made that speech to the United Nations, when he used very tough language about North Korea and those subsequent tweets, everyone criticised him, everyone said he was a joke, and now look where we are. We'll have to wait and see how those negotiations go. If he can secure this, maybe he deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. If he can pull it off, who else would have done more for world peace than securing that deal?
Chuka Muna.
Well, the first thing I would say is let's get this in perspective.
Was she right, first of all, before you move on? That if he's got it right, he deserves the Nobel Peace Prize.
Actually, we're pretty big. If you he would be pretty big. I don't trust the little guy, but she would be right.
Yeah. I'm not sure I can conceive of circumstances where we'd all be saying he should get the Nobel Peace Prize.
Helen Holland, you're on the Bristol City Council's cabinet. What do you think? Do you think it's possible Trump might get the Nobel Peace Prize for what he's done in North Korea?
I hope not. And I think my fear about the Iran issue is that him unilaterally withdrawing when other countries were begging him to stay in the process. I think that the thing that should have happened, surely, was he should have said, well, I've got a problem with this, and let the other countries, us included, renegotiate it with him rather than just pulling the plug on it. And I think we're in very, very scary times.
Well, he has no agreement with North Korea, let's be honest about this. The North Koreans are playing a clever game. It's unusual, but they're being smart there. And what we've seen here is Trump actually put a hole in any chance of him having any actual real agreement with the North Koreans, because the North Koreans know they can't trust him. The world actually knows we can't trust the North Koreans. So there's no long-term peace prospect there at the moment. I do hope, actually, that the Chinese, along with the South Koreans, can actually stitch something together for the long term. But the reality is Trump has not actually delivered
anything. What he's done is he's brought North and South Korea together, hasn't he, in a way that has not happened for decades.
No, I mean, I don't see how he's brought them together. I think North Korea has played a blinder with South Korea, and they are happy for Trump to claim credit at the moment. At the same time, let's wait and see this space on whether or not actually anything substantial happens. I mean, what Trump did around Iran and also around other agreements he's ripped up is he's pretty much said, you can't trust America, and also you need to understand, if you make a deal with me, the next guy might rip it up. That has completely broken the general rules of international diplomacy. The whole idea was, when you actually negotiated an international treaty, whoever your successors were would abide by that treaty. That is now out of the window, and that makes it actually very difficult long-term to agree anything with anybody.
Martin, Obama has spoken out, hasn't he, and said that this is absolutely unacceptable.
Well, the Iran situation.
Yeah.
Yes, well, it is. And, of course, what's now going to happen is there's going to be sanctions placed on European countries that continue trading with Iran. So it's not just anti-Iran. The Germans, who have got big interests that they want to pursue in Iran, are being told their companies will be sanctioned. So this is actually starting a trade war with Europe. That's what's going to happen. And, of course, a real war could easily start in the Middle East because the Israelis and the Syrians have been exchanging fire immediately after. As soon as Trump made his statement, the Israelis started attacking in Syria. And that's going to be the flashpoint. And, of course, I totally agree with what you said about Korea. The South Koreans have played a blinder. And the North Koreans, Kim Jong-un has played a blinder because he's actually said, I'm prepared to denuclearise, but you've got to sign a peace treaty with us, guaranteed by the Chinese. And of course, it could be quite possible to develop North Korea if the South Koreans and the Chinese were to put infrastructure and capital in there. You could reform North Korea without too much problem, and you could push it in a Chinese-style direction. And I think, I get the feeling that's where Kim Jong-un wants to go. But it's nothing to do with Trump. Trump has actually been, if anything, an obstacle to this. But, of course, the South Koreans very smartly have appealed to his ego and said, you can take the credit for it. And if it all comes off and Trump takes the credit for it, that's fine. I don't care about that as long as it's sorted.
OK, back at home, if you drive up and down the M32, you'll have spotted the tent city on the side of the M32, which looks like it may be evicted after human faeces was found in a Bristol park. The so-called tent city has nearly doubled in size since the beginning of March. 8 homeless people have died in the city in the past year. A couple of stories together there from the Bristol Post. But in a nutshell, maybe you can start with this one, Helen. I mean, the idea, surely, I mean, can we not provide some port-a-loos for people if they're having to camp in by the side of the M32 rather than just expect them to go and find a public toilet to use, which have been closed?
I think that homelessness is a very complex issue, and I take my hat off to what Paul Smith, the Housing Cabinet member, has been doing. And they aren't always the same people who are on the streets or in tents. And there are lots of organisations who go out, talk to people. I think that Paul was giving the figures the other week about how many people have actually been helped into housing from the streets. I think it was about 800 last week. But
there's people being evicted all the time. This is the trouble. Yeah, what about providing something for people to actually use as a toilet?
Well, he is doing that. There are some there's some housing in containers in Bedminster that an organisation has started, and he's working with them on that.
Can the council not afford a port-a-loo? It just seems a simple thing to do if this is the problem.
I don't know the answer to that, but I can certainly find out.
Tim, can the council afford a port-a-loo?
Yes. And they should provide it. I mean, whether or not the encampment should be allowed to stay there or not, I'm not going to get into. But while people are there, as part of good humanity, yes, we should provide a port-a-loo.
Okay, time for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guests, Cabinet Member for Adult Social Care and Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe and Witherwood, Heather Holland, and Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Join us after the news.
BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.